Today's Teisho will be on Case 32 in the Book of Serenity. Case 32 is entitled Yang Shan's Mind and Environment. Introduction. The ocean is the world of dragons, disappearing and appearing. They sport serenely. The sky is the home of cranes. They fly and call freely. Why does the exhausted fish stop in the shoals and a sluggish bird rest in the reeds? Is there any way to figure gain and loss? Case. Yang Shan asked a monk, "Where are you from?" The monk said, "From Yu province." Yang Shan said, "Do you ever think of that place?" The monk said, "I always think of it." Yang Shan said, "The thinker is the mind and the thought of is the environment. Therein are mountains, rivers, and the landmass, buildings, towers, halls and chambers, people, animals, and so forth. Reverse your thought to think of the thinking mind. Are there so many things there?" The monk said, "When I get here, I don't see any existence at all." Yang Shan said, This is right for the stage of faith, but not yet right for the stage of person." The monk said, "Don't you have any other particular way of guidance?" Yang Shan said, "To say that I have anything particular or not would not be accurate. Based on your insight, you only get one mystery. You can take the seat and wear the robe. After this, see on your own." Verse. All embracing with no outside, penetrating with no obstruction, gates and walls like cliffs, doors and locks redoubled. When the wine is always sweet, it lays out the guests. Though the meal is filling, it ruins the farmers. Bursting out of the clean sky, the Garuda takes wing on the wind. Treading over the blue sea, thunder falls the roaming dragon. Well, this is the first day of our sesshin, our 2009 January sesshin, and I want to thank everybody for doing such an excellent job today, this morning, with your practice. As I said last night, there's something really wonderful about the way we are practicing together. I mentioned last night that Gary was talking to somebody about practicing at a number of other Zen centers where he'd gone. And these places were very well established, and people who go there might be a little intimidated because they are so large and very formal and very finished, you know. A person who might be a beginner and who went there would feel sort of maybe out of place, because everybody would seem to be very accomplished, and there would be many rituals to observe and rules and so on. And would take a while to feel at ease in that environment. I myself have been to such places too, where there's a great deal of formality, many rules, and there's actually nothing wrong with that, but But our style here is a little different because this really isn't a temple. When we come here, we have to move all the furniture out of the room, and we have to do it all ourselves from scratch. So this is like a homemade sesshin. That phrase has been in my mind. It's really a beautiful way to practice. So everybody here today has come for 7 days for a true Chan Chi. And people have been doing this practice like this for more than 1,500 years. Really, actually, I don't know when the Chan Chi began. I don't know if 7 days of practice was done in India or not. I suspect that it is based on the Buddha's own enlightenment. As I recall, the Buddha is supposed to have sat motionless for 7 days during his Daikensho. So it's possible that 7 days has some connection with that story. I don't know if people did 7-day retreats in India or not. I know that in the Vipassana tradition, people do 10-day retreats, and I don't know where that number comes from either. But I do know that the sesshin, as we've been practicing it, has been around for at least 1,500 years, so it's a fairly long time. And people have gotten together under all kinds of circumstances to go through this beautiful process of purifying body, mind, and heart. And it's always wonderful. Last night somebody was coming to see me before the sesshin came to talk with me. And I was so happy to hear that what this person said. Basically, she said that usually with the approach of sesshin, she felt great anxiety and maybe even a little bit of anger. And I myself could certainly understand that. I used to think about sesshin with like a sort of like butterflies in my stomach, or like I was just about to go to take a very difficult test. You know, when I would think of sesshin approaching, I would become—I don't know how to put it. It would be almost like going up before the firing squad. You know. It would be that kind of a strange feeling, I don't know how to describe it, but it was like panic almost. So when she said this, I certainly understood. And then she said basically that she didn't feel that this time, that she felt very positive feelings about sesshin approaching. And I was so happy to hear that. It took me much longer than it's taken her. And of course, just because this happened once doesn't mean it will happen next time. Maybe as the next sesshin approaches, she will again feel anxiety. But over time, if you do this long enough, that feeling of going before the firing squad really goes away. And you really will, I promise you, look forward to sesshin with profound sense of joy. This morning when I was sitting, I was just so happy. And I was thinking, boy, this is really beautiful, this is really wonderful. Like everybody else, you know, I come to sesshin with, you know, all kinds of concerns and problems. It's easy to get caught up in life's complexities, you know. and to begin to feel very burdened by them. Right now, at Rutgers, we're struggling with massive budget cuts. And there are many problems that have to be worked out, including possibly having to lay people off and things like that. Could be very difficult, very painful. I'm involved with taking care of my father-in-law, who's not in very good health, and it's quite a challenge to take care of somebody who's in bad health and who's quite old. Those kinds of things are the complexities I've been dealing with. Other complexities too. So basically, you know, when I come to Sesshin, I too have to simplify my life and purify body, mind, and heart. And it's, you know, life can begin to seem so difficult and also just overwhelming in its complexity. So it seems that if you turn this way, you're trapped. And it might seem if you turn that way, you're trapped. And then if you turn this way, you know, life can have that quality. One of our members is Tony. So you all may know Tony. He's not at this session, but he's been communicating with me through the email. And Tony works for the Star Ledger. I don't know if you read the Star Ledger, but it's the major newspaper for New Jersey, and it's one of the largest newspapers in the United States. It's a very good newspaper. But newspapers are in real trouble. Imagine if you went to college and your goal, your dream was to be a newspaper man. Ray worked as a newspaper man. He's coming in a couple days. I myself worked briefly as a reporter. I didn't really want to be a reporter, but I had friends of mine who really wanted to be in the news business, and I can see why. It's really exciting and important. Lots of people, when they were in their 20s, decided that it would be wonderful to be a journalist. And they've worked very hard and done excellent reporting and spent countless hours staying up all night writing stories. And of course they've gone from little newspapers to bigger newspapers. You know, the way you usually start in journalism is to start at a small paper and then if you're good, you work your way up to a bigger paper, bigger newspaper. So people, thousands of people have lived like this, you know, for decades, and now their newspapers are failing all over the United States. In fact, just before I came to Sesshin, one of the newspapers in my hometown, or the place where I spent much of my life, Seattle, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer is going to go into bankruptcy unless somebody buys it soon. And the LA Times, the Chicago Tribune, all these famous newspapers that have won many prizes are in danger of closing their doors. Anyway, the Star Ledger is also in trouble, and Tony has been holding things together at the Star Ledger. He's been really one of the people keeping it going. So imagine that your job is on the line, you've worked for many, many years, you're good at what you do. It would be like my working at Rutgers and it looks like Rutgers is going to close, you know. I don't think that's going to happen, but the Star Ledger really might close. And so he gets up every day and has to struggle with numerous problems on many levels. And this can happen to anybody. So, you know, when we can come to, he couldn't come to Sesshin this time, he was at the last one, and I think it helped him very much. And as I said, he's been training. He gets up every morning and sits, and he's working on his koan. So this beautiful practice of purifying body, mind, and heart can be really wonderful. And when I come to Sesshin, I always realize I always realize that there's some purification to be done. You know, that I've held on to some things, and that I've trapped myself in certain ways. And so Sesshin is just this wonderful opportunity to live a different way, to really experience like this profound freedom and really great happiness and openness. It's really, I just think, the most precious thing in the world. So here we are doing this. And our koan today is really intended for people who have been practicing for a while. Yangshan is meeting this Zen monk. We don't know how much practice the monk has had, and we don't know, we don't know what Yangshan is up to at first. So it becomes clear that Yangshan is sort of testing the monk to see what stage of the practice he's in. So he says to him, "Where do you come from?" And the monk says, "I'm from Yu province." And Yangshan says, "Do you think of that place?" And the monk says, I always think of it. I think of it all the time." So maybe the monk has come to study with Yangshan, and Yangshan is interested about what's going on in his head. And maybe he guesses that maybe the monk is a little homesick, you know. So Yangshan says, "Do you think of that place?" And the monk says, "I think of it all the time. I'm sitting on the cushion and I'm thinking about my home, and I'm away from my home." Maybe the monk is wishing he was back in his home. And so when he sits on the cushion, he just keeps thinking about home. Maybe something else is, another person coming to Sesshin might be thinking about something that happened at work. Or another person coming to Sesshin might be thinking about some personal problem, you know. Or there's a million different things, right? And sitting on the cushion, just going over and over these things in your mind, you know. So then Yangshan says, he begins to offer some help or some meditation instruction. He says, "The thinker is the mind, and the thought of is the environment." So there's like the mind and its environment, right? So the mountains, the rivers, the landmass, buildings, towers, these are part of the environment, right? So Rutgers, the Star Ledger, all of this is part of the environment. He says, instead of thinking about the environment, you know, your home, your relationship, your work, whatever is consuming your attention, he says, reverse the current of your thought to the thinking mind. Are there so many things there? Now this is really quite difficult. This takes quite a bit of practice. You know, most people just have thoughts, you know. They aren't able to distance themselves from their thoughts. And they have feelings, emotions, and so on. Images pop up in their heads, and there's no space between their awareness and their thoughts or their perception, you know. So an ordinary person has a thought, and then another thought, and another thought, and usually these thoughts produce emotions. And the thoughts are linked together like in a chain, and they just sweep people along, and people are carried along without really much control over what happens. You can't really control what pops into your head very easily, anyway. you can't really stop your thoughts from arising. So, most people are really almost like prisoners of their thoughts. People think that they have thoughts. You can say, I had a thought just now, but actually that's quite misleading. Because we really aren't in control, ordinary people aren't really in control of their thoughts. It would be more accurate to say, a thought just had me. A thought just had me a moment ago. In fact, that would really be accurate, you know. People are kind of like possessed by their thoughts. And some people become obsessive or neurotic or even, become neurotic because they can't free themselves from these obsessive chains of thoughts. And then they have to go to the doctor and get the antidepressant and things like that because they can't stop the flow of thoughts and they can't get out of it, you know. So this thought arises, and that's the normal state of ordinary people, in my opinion. They try to change thoughts so that you can try to think of something else, but it's very difficult because the thoughts arise from some mysterious place and they sweep you along and then they drift off and you're carried from thought to thought. But people who do Zen begin to have the capacity, the ability to separate themselves from their thoughts. So instead of having a thought, you see a thought. Or instead of having an emotion, you see the emotion. This is, if you've been doing meditation for a couple of years, this might happen to you, and you might think it's trivial. But it's actually quite important. Most people you meet have never done that, you know. They simply have thoughts. And they imagine that they're the masters of their thoughts. Like philosophers imagine that they're the masters of their thoughts, but they're not at all. It's really an illusion. They're having thoughts all the time, and where those thoughts come from, they don't know. And they don't even think about that question. But if you do Zen, you begin to have some space between yourself and your thoughts. And you begin to realize that your thoughts are not you. Right? Your thoughts are not you. You don't have to be in the thought. You can see it as though there's like a little distance. Or your emotions are not you. You know, some people just get mad, but if you practice Zen long enough, you see your anger. And then you might say, oh, I don't want to be angry. Or is that coming out of me? Ooh. And that can, you can have thoughts like that too. You can suddenly have a thought that is stunningly unpleasant. And you think, gosh, did I just think that? Well, please don't feel too guilty because, as I say, thoughts are coming out of a place you can't control. But when the thoughts arise, you don't have to be possessed by them. If you watch your breath and you watch your breath and you watch your breath, eventually a space will open up between you and your thoughts. And this is like the beginning of real liberation. If you can open a space between yourself and your thoughts, and you realize that these thoughts are not really you, you already gain a great deal of freedom because now you're not going to be responding in a conditioned way. I don't know if you ever have had this dream, but I still have it after many, many years. I have a dream sometimes where I have to go take a test or I'm in a test. And I realize that I haven't done any of the work for the test. I don't know if you ever had that dream, but I'm seated in a room and I'm taking a test or I'm about to take a test. I'm taking the test and sometimes it's like I realize the test is coming up in about a week. And I realize that I signed up for the course, but that I got so busy I forgot to do any of the reading for the course and I didn't go to any of the lectures. And then I have like, you know, like an anxiety dream, because I'm really like, it's like, oh my God, how could I have let things go to such a degree, you know? And then I always wake up and think, well, wait a minute, I didn't take that. Did I take that course? No, you know. Phew, so glad, right? It's like being possessed by this, these thoughts. When you can distance yourself from your thoughts a little bit by watching the breath, it's like waking up. It's like my waking up after that dream, you know. You can suddenly realize, well, wait, that's not real. And so a lot of early stage of meditation practice is distancing ourselves from our thoughts. This is very, very important. Because, you know, that dream I have about not having done my test is really created by, you know, school, right? I mean, teachers want you to study for the test, and they actually make testing a nerve-wracking situation. See, really, you know, education isn't really supposed to necessarily make people relaxed. So they want you to stay up all night and study, right? And so if they make the test too pleasant, you might not do that. So if you come in and they say, hi, how are you? Are you ready for the test? Yes. Good, you know, relax. You're in a comfortable chair, you know. If you have trouble with the questions, you can just stop the test, go home and study some more, and when you're ready, come on back, you know. And, you know, actually, you might never learn all the material. You might never, because, you know, you just, well, you come back, you study a little bit, you know. So they figure you need some pressure, right? You need to be pressured. And they've made a testing situation actually kind of a pressure situation, right? And so the idea is that if they put pressure on you, you'll really study, and you'll see it as a challenge, and you'll really try hard, right? And of course, that means when you go home, if you didn't study one aspect of the chapter, you might beat yourself up a little bit. And actually, the whole system is designed to get you to do that. That's just how our educational system works a lot of the time. So that dream of going in to take the test and going, my God, I didn't read any of the material, that's like a socially produced anxiety dream, right? In fact, years ago I worked for a woman named Colleen McElroy who ran a special education unit at the University of Washington. And she actually said, your job is to give your students that dream. And she said, the problem with these students is that they don't have that dream, but they need to wake up in a cold sweat sometime because they didn't do the reading for the test. She said, your job is to make them wake up with a cold sweat. Isn't that interesting? It sounds cruel, but many of her students went on to medical school and law school. So it's a little bit complicated, you know. Maybe that dream is good in some ways, but culture, conditioning, these two things go together. You know, culture is always conditioning us. And so, you know, even now, along, you know, like 30 years after I got my PhD, or 25 years after I got my PhD, I'm still anxious about not having read material for some test, you know. Culture, our upbringing, our society is doing this to us all the time. Actually, if everybody's doing it to us, a lot of the time we're just driven almost crazy, right? Because we're worried about this, and we're worried about this. You know, you're worried, not only are you worried about the test, but you're worried about whether you look good, you're worried about whether you're tall enough. It's like everybody's creating these anxieties to get you to do something. And we're sort of prisoners of this until we can separate ourselves from our thoughts and our emotions and see them from a distance, right? And then it's possible to experience the world in a different way. It takes a little work, but Zen practice is really very much about that. So this guy is sitting on the cushion all day thinking about his home, and basically Yangshan says, well, look, instead of watching your thoughts, instead of thinking about your home, try to turn your attention, he doesn't say to the breath, he says turn your attention to the mind itself. See, try to look at your mind. So this is like mu practice, right? One way to think about mu is that we're actually turning away from the objects of thought, our thoughts, our ideas, and our emotions, to the mind itself. Actually, you might not have thought about mu that way, but mu is really like the mind itself. So when you look at your mind and there isn't any thought there or any memory or image, it's just a blank screen, you're looking at the mind itself without any content, you could say. So Yangshan says, look at the mind itself. You've been thinking about you, your homeland. Now look at the mind itself. What do you see? And when the monk looks, he says, I don't see anything. Ah, that's great. See, I don't see anything. Okay. So that takes a long time. That takes many, many years, you know, 2, 3, 4 years before you can reach that stage. Yeah. So we're possessed by our thoughts. We're obsessively manipulated by our conditioning. We have all of these emotions that tear us to pieces. Right? Tear us to pieces. And we can't break free of them for a long time. But eventually, if you keep watching your breath or going into mu, you get some distance, and it's like finally having some freedom, having some real freedom. And then there's a bit of a split between yourself, your awareness of things, and your pure mind without form. You know, so on the cushion, you can enter into this blank mind, and basically you can go out of your thoughts and into blank mind, out of your thoughts and into blank mind, or from blank mind into the world of sound and shape. So you could be in deep mu shin, and you could open your eyes and look around and see sunlight on the floor of the zendo, for example. See, and this is pretty much where the monk is at this stage. He's able to go into deep mu shin, and he's able to come out and enter the world of form. And that's this monk has been practicing for some time, I would say. And so that's a very good accomplishment. However, this is incomplete in some ways, and that's what Yangshan points out to him. Yangshan says, that's good for the stage of faith, but not yet right for the stage of the person. Now, this stage of faith and stage of person is based upon a particular Chinese Buddhist scripture where they outline levels of attainment. And the first is stage of faith, the second is stage of contemplation, the third is stage of cultivation, the fourth is stage of practice, the fifth is stage of relinquishment. See? So there's like a system, you know. And he says, well, that's okay, but you're only at like a stage one. But you're not ready for a higher stage. And then the monk says, okay, well, what would you advise me to do next? You know, do you have any advice? And Yangshan says, I'm not going to give you any advice. I want you to, based on what you already know, I want you to sit down and see on your own, see what you notice. So So he's really, Yangshan's really a good teacher. He's saying, you have a question, please investigate it, right? I mean, the question is now, what's wrong with going into Mushin, or you know, going deep into Mushin, or coming out and being in the world of form? What's wrong with that? Yangshan said something's wrong with it. See, but he didn't say what. You know, Yangshan's a really good teacher because he says, please use your mu power to investigate. Zen is all about entering deep mushin and then investigating reality without being prisoners of our fears and our attachments and our ideas and our conditioning. And so, Yangshan says, something's wrong with the practice where you're just sitting on the cushion thinking about your home. A more advanced stage is entering deep mushin. But if you just stay in deep mushin, or you go to mushin and then you go into the world of form, and you go into mushin and you go into the world of form, something's still wrong with that. What's wrong? Well, I'm not as good a teacher as Yangshan, so I'd like to give you a hint. I think Zen is all about, I think Buddhism is all about living in an undivided world, you know, a world without barriers. We create barriers. We create all kinds of barriers. And you could say we're constantly dividing ourselves from the world. And this is a part of, this is the cost of having a brain like we have, you know. We think in terms of symbols and words and ideas. This is how we experience the world, and they're always creating like barriers. And I think that at its most extreme, this way of thinking leads people to believe in like heaven. When people talk about heaven and earth, they usually mean that earth is fallen and unhappy and evil place and so on, and heaven is like perfect, right? And this is a divided world, right? It's like our world is divided in two in this way. There's other ways to divide the world too. But the point is, a lot of the time, we create a boundary between ourselves and the world. We say, this is right and this is wrong, this is good, this is bad. This tastes good, this tastes bad. I like this, I don't like this. And I think Zen and Buddhism in general are all about experiencing the world as like one life, unity. Even in Zen practice, we can create a barrier. We can create a separation between our mu and the world. You know, when you're in deep mushin, you can feel really great. It's so sweet and delicious to be in mu, in the samadhi of mu sometimes. And it's very important to be able to go deeply in there. And so you sit down on the cushion and you go deeply into mushin, and you go in a mu, mu. Pretty soon, it's like your body, if you're really sitting deeply, your body disappears. If you're lucky, you know, your pain will disappear for a while. You might feel like you're floating on air, and every breath is just wonderful. I don't know if this has happened to you at this session, but I'm sure at some point you've had one of these sits where it's just like eating sugar, right? It's so sweet and so beautiful to be in deep samadhi and have everything disappear. But when we do this, we can develop like sense of separation from everything around us, you know? So it's very important to overcome that sense of separation. And we do this, one way to do this is through koan training. Koan training asks us to investigate some aspect of the moment. Go into mushin and then return to the moment and notice something new about it. Or investigate, see. But when we go into mushin and then we turn back to the world, we have the chance to create a deeper unity. You know, it's really, this is a deeper unity. And when the world becomes more unified, it immediately produces all kinds of positive results. You know, we feel happier, we feel energy, we, you know, joy, etc. One way to think about Zen practice is that it's moving back and forth from deep mushin. It has to be really deep mushin, back into the world of form. And little by little, the distinction between these two, which seems so profound, begins to disappear. You know, in the Diamond Sutra, we recite a line, we recite it in Japanese phonetic pronunciation of Chinese phonetic pronunciation of Sanskrit, so you might have missed it. Okay. But it says, form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. Now, if you read sutras as philosophical propositions, they're not going to make any sense. And I'm sure many philosophy students have read the Diamond Sutra and walked away scratching their head. But the sutras are describing the way reality is experienced in a certain state of consciousness. So ultimately, the conscious, the diamond mind described by the Diamond Sutra is a state without barriers. And it's where the difference between mu and form, sound, a taste, or sight has disappeared. And this is reality. This is reality, but it's very difficult for humans to experience reality. If you keep practicing Zen, however, first you have to be able to find mu, and then we begin to move from mu into the world and back into mu and into the world and back, and this goes on and on for a long time. But little by little, the barriers between the barriers fall, and little by little, the truth of this statement that form is emptiness and emptiness form becomes obvious. Becomes obvious. And this is really quite a wonderful experience when you have these moments where the emptiness of form becomes clear to you, or the emergence of form out of emptiness is something you personally witness. It's really quite wonderful. I was reading doing some reading for this project that I've been working on, this book, and I was reading this physicist whose name is his name escapes me right now, but he is the physicist who is a key figure in string theory, Stephen Hawking. And in one of his books, Stephen Hawking says, he said, it's odd, you know. He said, but if you take all of the forces in the universe, all, you know, there's different kinds of energy in the universe, and they affect one another in different ways. So you might say one form of energy pushes and one form of energy pulls, see. And one form of energy expands and one form of energy contracts. So he said, the interesting thing is that if you take all the different, you take all the different forms of energy and you add them together, what you get is zero. Isn't that interesting? He said, all the forms of energy in the universe, if you tally them up, they cancel each other out and you end up with zero, shunya.
Wu, Mu.
And he said, it's a strange thing, right? But he says, actually, the whole universe is produced by, he says, instability in nothingness. It's produced by an instability in nothingness. Now, for physics, you know, that's pretty amazing, but we Zen people have, you know, we're not physicists, but that doesn't surprise anybody in the Zen world. Because things are coming out of nothingness and going back into nothingness from moment to moment, as we can witness, if we cultivate our awareness. We don't have to read about it, and don't take my word for it, just keep practicing the way you've been practicing this morning. So, I think it's exciting. Beautiful, this beautiful world arising out of emptiness and going back into emptiness forever and ever. Beautiful, breathtaking. And you can see it on your cushion if you keep practicing. When something arises out of emptiness, no matter what it is, it's absolutely stainlessly pure. Basically, as we're going through the day, you know, something may bother us, something may be troubling or disturbing, something, but that's far from deepest mind. You know, if you go into Mu enough, when you come out and you confront the thing that bothers you, you'll notice that it's lost its negative characteristics, and it's just present in its pure existence. And oddly, when we experience things in their pure existence, they seem wonderful, no matter what they are. Even like cold, you know. I mean, the heater is on, and I'm not going to turn it off. But even when it's really cold, you know, you could think, I hate the cold. My father-in-law is 90 years old, and it snowed the other day. And I get up and I do my zazen, and then I come downstairs, and he gets up early too, actually. He's getting up usually when I'm done my zazen, and then I make him breakfast. And it was snowing, and I said, "Oh, isn't that beautiful?" He said, "No." He said, "I hate this cold, you know." And maybe I'll feel the same way when I'm 90. But you know, usually that reaction is a small mind reaction. You know, so if you sit on the cushion long enough. And you get out of your mental habits, you know, when you experience something like the cold, it can feel thrilling, you know, really thrilling. And that goes for anything that bothers you, you know. When you go deeply into Mushin and then you encounter the world of form, it's like everything's been, not only has your mind, body, and heart been washed clean, but it's like washing the world clean. It's like, suddenly this thing that seems so menacing or so wrong, so disturbing, so annoying, it just seems like beautiful, right? Like beautiful. Wonderful. So this is a really great thing to do, I think, this zazen. Yangshan asked a monk, "Where are you from?" The monk said, "From Yu province." Yangshan said, "Do you often think of that place?" The monk said, "I think of it all the time." Yangshan said, "The thinker is the mind and the thought of is the environment. In the environment are mountains, rivers, and the landmass, buildings, towers, halls, chambers, people, animals, and so forth. The world of form." Now, he said, reverse your thought and just look at your own mind. Are there so many things there? The monk said, "When I get there, I don't see anything at all." Yangshan said, "Good. But this is just an intermediate stage. You know, please integrate." Yeah? The monk said, "Is there a particular way of integrating?" Yangshan said, "To say that I have anything particular or not would be inaccurate. Based on your insight, you only get this one mystery. you can take, you know, get down, sit on your cushion, put on your robe and sit on your cushion and observe, you know, watch. After this, see on your own. Well, of course, we have koans to help us, so that's a good thing. We all have to see on our own, but a little help is okay. Verse, all embracing with no outside, see? No barrier. Everything is one life. Whenever we feel separate, that's illusion. That's illusion. All embracing with no outside, penetrating with no obstruction. Gates and walls like cliffs. Doors and locks redoubled. When the wine is always sweet, it lays out the guests. Though the meal is filling, it ruins the farmers. Bursting out of the clear sky. There's always like these contradictions in life, right? There's always like these, you know, when we're with the small mind, it's like, you know, people, wine is sweet, but everybody gets drunk and has a hangover. The meal is filling, but somebody, you know, somebody suffers. So bursting, but it doesn't have to be like that. Bursting out of the clear sky, the Garuda takes wing on the wind. The Garuda is like a magical bird. It flies to the highest heavens. Treading over the blue sea, thunder follows the roaming dragon. You know, these are creatures who know no barriers. Right? You can be a Garuda, you can be a dragon. So this is like a dragon training center. So let's be dragons today.